Brigadier Clabby, Reel 3. How did morale stand up under Indian climatic conditions?
Yes, well, here I'm really thinking of... I didn't really know the British troops in India. I was never in stations where they were... where I was on sort of intimate terms with British units. So what I'm really talking about is young British officers working out with Indian regiments. And here they, some of them at any rate, would get very paranoid, as it were, during the hot weather. And to my knowledge, in Peshawar, in one season, we had three suicides amongst young officers. In each case, it was a matter of the subaltern having been ticked off, probably very deservedly, by his CO or company commander, and going away and apparently just shooting himself. It had some amusing consequences for me, as a matter of fact. And this was with my delightful 18th Cavalry, who were a cheerful lot. And when one of their young subalterns would get ticked off, I got sent for on several occasions by the major, whoever it was, had given the reprimand and said, "Will you go and sit with so-and-so, because I've just ticked him off, and, you know, he's had the odd suicide. I don't want the wretched boy to shoot himself." So I'd simply walk over to this chap's bungalow with a bottle of whiskey and say, "I've been told to stop you committing suicide." And he'd say, "Jolly good." And we'd drink the bottle of whiskey together. But it was a thing one had to watch. But you could get... The hot weather was not just hot, it was also very dusty, and sometimes you get these high winds with dust storms. And it could be very uncomfortable with dust and heat and general misery around. It was not nice.
Did you know any did you serve under any famous soldiers whilst you were in India?
Well, quite a lot. You see, the Northwest Frontier particularly was a training ground for the British Army and the Indian Army. And the three I can remember best is Auchinleck, who was brigade commander in Peshawar and was commanding in the moment operations when I was up there. I think O'Connor took over from him, and another chap I served under, and this was under in the Loyaga operations, was Alexander, again then a brigade commander.
What was your opinion of these men?
Oh, of course, they were absolutely first rate. And one could easily understand them going on. They knew their job backwards. There would be various lectures that they gave, and they always spoke with tremendous authority and competence. And I should say one regarded these people as very good professional soldiers, whom you admired a great deal for their knowledge. Naturally, at my level, one never got to know them. We merely knew them as brigade commanders and so on.
Can we talk about a little bit about this Zob area you were in? Mm-hmm. What was it a very wild type of region?
No, it wasn't. Well, it was certainly an isolated region. We were about 50 miles from railhead. I think the nearest rail was a little place called Hindu Bagh, and it was about 200 miles from Quetta by road. The rail did run to Quetta, of course, but only just. And then there was another rail head down the hill. I forget the name of the place, but that was about 60 or 70 miles away, and with a very rickety bit of road which always gave way when the rains were heavy. So you lived a nice, isolated life. And in those days, aircraft were extremely infrequent. In fact, you practically never saw an aeroplane. I think there was a squadron at Quetta and another at Karachi, but they never came our way very much. This is RAF. So you were a nice, isolated, independent brigade, that is, independent of division or district headquarters, and responsible directly to Army Command. But there was very little tribal trouble in that area. I remember the brigadier there being very cross. I'd just come from Peshawar the moment the Leh Yagra ops were over. So I had a frontier gong, you see, as a very young officer. And this annoyed my new brigadier very much, because none of his young officers had got this frontier medal. So he decided that he'd better have a war too. And he did his damnedest. He had us out in column. He trailed his coat all round what he thought might be troublesome areas, but nobody would take a pot shot at him. So you can't. It was not a troublesome area from that angle.
You call the medals gongs, did you?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. From the ship?
No, it was just a round thing, you know.
Didn't you say that there was a notorious brigand in this
area? Oh, yes, we had a very splendid brigand, I forget his name, but leading from Fort Sandeman to Lorelei were two roads. You took the roads north straight out of Lorelei, and then the left-hand branch would take you to Quetta. Then you came to a turning, and you could turn right into Fort Sandeman. Alternatively, there was the straight road to Fort Sandeman. And this brigand had the greatest pleasure in doing a sort of highwayman's act on one road or the other. And there was, I suppose, the best part of 50 or 60 miles of desert in between each branch of the road. So he could skip from one branch to the other. And when you needed a bit of exercise, you could have the whole brigade out chasing this across these 50 miles. We never caught him. And he was a great source of enthusiasm on the part of the troops. If anybody could have got him, of course, it would have been wonderful. But he was our one and only enemy, and dearly cherished.
Were there Baluches in this area?
Yes, yes.
What did you think of them compared
to... One had very little contact with them, I'm afraid, apart from the few, you know, sort of what you might call farmer types. You got the, Pawinda coming down from the north in sort of camel trains, but you had very little contact with these people.
Can you tell me what your experience was in these Leh Yagra operations?
The usual system for any of these operations was to build a road into the troublesome area. So the first stage of the operation was the column. In this case, it was a Naushera column going out, which would consist of usually one British battalion, probably one Indian battalion, plus a squadron of cavalry, perhaps, not in the Leh Yagra ops, and with all this second-line mule transport I was telling you about. Then you get to where the road ended, and you'd proceed to endeavour to build a road into the troublesome village. And here, of course, the fun would start. You'd sort of patrol through the country and take up picketing positions on either side of your line of advance. You would seldom, if ever, bring the enemy to battle. It was all a matter of ambush and sniping and night work and... they'd lie up at night and shoot into the camp. And you just gradually push your way through, build your road, and come to by that. These operations usually started towards the end of the harvest, when the local chaps had nothing much to do and probably feeling a bit bored, and thought a shooting match would be in order. So when that little bit of the operations was over, probably in about 2 months, you'd sign a little treaty, come to some agreement, which usually included paying the village to maintain the road which you'd built towards them, which gave them a nice annual income, and operations were over. It was all very neat and tidy, with remarkably little bad blood about it.
But in these La Hagra operations, didn't you find... Wasn't there any danger involved at all?
Oh, there's always danger involved, but not very great. There was one very nasty little incident in that campaign, in that operation, where the local chaps surprised a whole picket and, I think, killed probably about a dozen men. This picket was one. You'd build these pickets. Your camp would be sort of on fairly low ground, and you'd have to picket the hills around so as to limit the chances of the enemy sniping into the camp. But the enemy obviously then took on the picket, which was a little isolated unit of perhaps at the most about a dozen men. And in this case, they surprised the picket and wrote it off. I think it was a mountain battery picket, but it was quite a gallant little action. But that was the first time I met Brigadier Alexander, as he then was, because I'd been called in as a sort of consultant veterinary officer. The original veterinary officer who'd gone out with the column had quarrelled with the transport officer, and to pay him back, had declared all his mules were unfit for active service because of quite a mild skin infection, which was not uncommon.
And were they unfit?
No. But I was sent, I was in Peshawar at the time, and I got whistled into the office by my CO, and he said, you ought to go straight out on these operations, so-and-so has happened. I don't think you'll find anything wrong, but the war has been stopped because they have got no mule transport. So I went and looked at them and found that they really were not badly affected. It was not causing any harm. So the mules were made operational again and the war restarted. But however, I was telling you, when it got to Roadhead, and then one got either onto a mule or a pony and trekked off towards brigade headquarters. And there I found... halfway there, sort of riding along, there was Brigadier Alexander with his staff looking over this the site of the previous night's action against this little picket. And he just said a kindly word or two, sort of, who are you? And then sort of lost all further interest, of course.
And what about the Moment operations? Were these a bigger thing?
That was a far bigger job, as a matter of fact. That was, I think, practically a whole division out. Certainly two brigades. That was Auchinleck in charge. And we got right up into the Moment country, doing much the same sort of drill. It was a much more magnificent operation, which they used as a sort of almost a mobilisation plan. Everybody from the medicals and S&T, ordnance and so on, deployed what you might call all their sort of mobilisation plans. For instance, halfway through, I got a nasty dose of malaria and would normally have just gone into hospital at Peshawar. But the medicals had decided to use their full mob scheme and had opened up a base hospital at Rawalpindi, which was another 100 miles away. So I got shipped back, quite unnecessary, with malaria, right back to Rawalpindi, into what they call the base hospital. And they were using Peshawar, you might say, for the acute cases of gunshot and so forth. But casualties were not high. I was messing again with the 18th Cavalry on these operations, and at the end point of the ops, we were living in this Moment village with mud walls all around, and our mess table, of course, it was an open courtyard, and we'd have our dinner, and revolvers would be fully loaded, lying on the table, and then you get the odd sniper pooping off, and the major in charge of this squadron, absolute dear and great friend of mine, say, "Gentlemen, the enemy." And you pick up your revolvers and walk outside the wall and fire all four revolvers sort of roughly in the line of the shot. Then you look back again. And it was, as I say, a little bit unfair sometimes to refer to them as the enemy. They were very good fighters, but it was according to rules. I did ride out with the... Normally, as a veterinary officer, of course, your job was simply attending to casualties, but I did ride out with this with a couple of troops when they went into action. And usually their job was to, as fast-moving troops, was quickly secure high ground, you see, and then infantry could come up. And the idea was always to gallop into action and trot out. And I must say it was quite an experience, trying to keep your horses at trot coming out with people shooting at you. I'm tending to go faster and faster.
Were any of you, any people close to you casualties in this campaign?
No. One got the odd horse wounded, but otherwise I didn't know any of the troops being hit.
What were the main problems for you as a veterinary officer on this campaign?
Colic and injuries, you might say, were the main bothers. Saddle sores. Really and truly, a lot of it was a matter of good management, good animal management. If you got well-trained troops, you got very little bother. If you got badly trained, a bad unit, you get a lot of trouble from colic because they hadn't been managed their feeding properly, getting too much sand, and of course they were on open lines, on sand, so, which they tended to eat. So you've got quite a lot of trouble from sand colic, but here again, some horses did and some didn't, and you could do things like putting muzzles on horses which were liable to eat sand. And again, a lot of your troubles were in simply the way they picketed their horses. You used one rope on the forefoot and one on the hind foot, you see. And you could, if you did this carefully, there was never enough rope for the animal to get the other hind foot entangled in it. You know, you had it, as it were, strung out. Not painfully in any way, but it just hadn't sufficient room to move. But a sort of bad unit would allow a lot of slack in that rope, and they'd get a lot of rope galls in the hollow of the heel, which was a very painful, nasty wound which took a lot of healing.
A rope gall.
That and saddle galls, again, was a matter of good saddle fitting and proper loading, and very little in good units. Or kicks, and these were rarely one's worries.
And were the units you were dealing with on the moment operations good units in this respect, or bad units?
On the whole, yes. You always had trouble in the first week or two when you sort of, you got out of cantonment and started rarely living in the open. And until people learnt the proper drills, they tended to be careless and you got injuries and trouble. The odd stampede and things like this.
And you said earlier on that the Pathans who you were fighting against fought the campaigns according to certain rules. What did you think to the Pathans who you were fighting against?
Well, I don't know. One had so little real contact with them. The chaps who, you might say, really hated Pathans, of course, were the various Indians, of particularly Pathans, perhaps, who had a particular zid, as they called, a particular dislike for that variety of Pathan.
What is the word?
Zid, that they, you know, they'd have an utter sort of ingrown dislike of that sort of variety of human being, and they would regard them as the most ghastly types. But I don't think the British officers, or men for that matter, had any thought on the matter. They were just somebody over there, you never saw them. And they really didn't cause you very much worry.
What was the attitude of the Gurkhas towards the Pathans?
Oh, the Gurkhas, of course, were enthusiastic headhunters. They regarded this as a splendid game. The Gurkha units I knew, they loved night work. They liked nothing better than sort of if the Waziers or whatever thought they'd do a little bit of sniping and stalking at night, what the Gurkha loved to do was to go out and stalk the stalker. And they were very fierce little men who simply adored fighting. And I don't know if it was any more than fox hunting to them. You know, this was a quarry.
And with what success did they meet?
Oh, pretty good. Oh, they were very good. They enjoyed it so much. You know, they thought about it and slept about it and talked about it. This was their life. And if somebody could cut off somebody else's head, it was absolute joy. But I think this was no animosity. It was just all in the game.
The heads were just trophies,
weren't they? Oh, just trophies, yeah.
Can you tell me under what condition... can we go on to everyday life? And mm-hmm. Can you tell me what accommodation you had in India?
Mm. The usual... Well, I had the usual. I was sort of a subaltern, young captain there, and the usual accommodation was half a bungalow. That would be one large living room and a smaller bedroom and the ghusl khana, the bathroom come lavatory, which was just a tin bath and a thunder box with a little hole behind where the sweeper, if you remember to find out that you were not sitting on the thunder box, but sometimes he did while he was sitting on it, could remove the pot from under you as regards the lavatory. And of course, filling your bath was a matter of your bearer bringing in a tin of an old petrol tin as a rule, full of hot water, and then the water carrier would bring in the cold water as necessary, and that was your sort of sanitary arrangement. The bedroom was simply a very plain little room with a charpoy, that is a string bed, wooden legs, and a mosquito net, which was very necessary, of course. The drugs used against malaria in those days were not very efficient. And the sitting room was a largish room, I suppose, about average about sort of 20 by 12, that sort of size room, with a rush matting on the floor. If you were in somewhere like Peshawar or Pindi, that would probably be have its own little population of scorpions. In the older bungalows, you would have a thatched roof with a sort of sheet underneath it to stop things falling on you. And you'd hear things, snakes and so on, rushing about overhead. But one seldom saw snakes, as a matter of fact. You'd see a few. They'd come along. But they were not a major nuisance by any means. One got the odd one coming into the bungalow and hiding under the sofa and things like this, and one always carefully knocked out one's shoes in case there were scorpions around. And it was always thought advisable to pull back a sheet and make certain that there wasn't a snake or anything inside, but I never found one personally, either a snake or a scorpion in the slippers. But one always looked. It was just as well.
Did you fall sick in India, apart from that bout of malaria you mentioned?
Dysentery was the main hazard. I had several goes of that, which was not surprising, because the sanitation was almost nil. The standards of hygiene in the kitchen were quite abysmal. And the...
Was this the mess kitchen, you mean?
Yes. When I say you lived in a bungalow, you'd walk across to the mess, which was probably 100 yards away. That's where you would have your social life, and your dinner every night. But, I'm sorry, I forget the question.
About sickness. There was
sickness. Dysentery was the main hazard. Usually used to clear up under rather drastic treatment with things like Epsom salts and castor oil. The idea was to clean you out as far as possible, and taking no food about 2 or 3 days. But it was probably the most unpleasant condition, and probably the commonest.
Were you passing blood?
Yes. And that, and the other nasty one, which everybody had at least once, was sandfly fever, which was a very nasty, acute fever with a very horrid headache, lasting about sort of 4 or 5 days. But usually you're left an immunity. So that was your first experience of India, was probably dysentery and sandfly fever.
Did you always boil the water that you drank?
It was supposed to be. And, of course, a lot of people probably rather wisely struck to soda water and things like this. But the water was. On that side, there was a sort of fairly careful drill. And as long as the kitchen staff, the dining room staff, stuck to it, it was well looked after in this way. Because when you went out on operations, the hazards increased because of flies, which were very prevalent. And in those days, you hadn't got aerosols and so on to... you had, but not to the same extent as you have now.
What was the food like? Was it British style or Indian style?
Mixture of both. You had quite a lot of curry. For your evening meal, you usually had a typical English dinner with soup and fish and meat and potatoes and vegetable and a sweet. The breakfasts varied wildly. The traditional one, for instance, on Sunday morning consisted of mulligatawny soup and followed by something like rumble tumble, which was scrambled eggs and bacon. Lunch was very often an Indian-style meal with curry, and certainly, traditionally, Sunday lunch was curry. And it was a great thing on Sundays to go out to restaurants or the club and have a curry lunch.